Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. It is my great pleasure to have surreal landscape artist John Oberdorf join us today. He's a dear friend of mine. He's an associate of mine. He is a phenomenal artist who brings landscapes to life like I have never seen. Literally, you go into his paintings. You actually experience that you're there. Welcome, my dear friend, John Oberdorf, to It's Rainmaking Time. Good day.
Hi, Kim.
I'm so excited to have you on the show. It's been, what, 6 years?
Well, it's been quite a while. I'm not that great a judge of time, but it's been quite a while. Yeah, it's nice to be with you.
I remember the last time we had you on the show, we were talking with the giclée artist, the man who invented giclées.
I think that's right.
And time has flown.
It has.
It's now 2010. And I really want to introduce you and your work to the public. You have a background early on as a draftsman and sculptor. You moved into painting. You've done illustrations for magazines, children's magazines. You've done cartoons. And you've also done work for Omni, Twilight Zone, and Ace Books. You did one of their covers. Talk to us about the earlier part of your work and what you're doing now and what you see that you're going to be moving into as an artist.
Well, I've never necessarily felt that one had to automatically change their style every few years, but you do have a natural tendency to discover new things, and different things interest you as you go along. You can return to the past also. We don't have to totally abandon where we've come from visually as artists. I started out mostly doing illustration work. I was interested in what we call sword and sorcery illustration at one time. People like Frank Frazetta fascinated me, and I did a little bit of that type of work. That entailed using the human form along with the background landscape. After a while, when I started moving mostly into my own kind of surreal approach, I found that the landscapes were meaning more to me than the figures that I put into them. I was always intrigued by background landscapes in Frazetta's work and others, and painters like N.C. Wyeth and folks like that. So I learned a lot along the way, but I started doing my own work, and I favored the traditional approach to painting in oils. And I still do that to this day, although sometimes I'll use an acrylic undercoat like a wash, and I'll paint through that with oil. For the last few years, I've been concentrating on oil paintings and landscapes. For the last 5 years, I've been concentrating on landscapes in Oregon, where I happen to be, mostly for commercial reasons because people like landscapes, but I've always felt that one could never really compromise themselves as an artist by doing a landscape. You learn too much by doing it, and it really kind of opened up my palette and has affected in a positive way my more surreal landscape paintings. I say surreal in that they're concocted from my own mind, and I try to make them as real and bring them into as real a state as possible.
They're deep, they're rich, they're otherworldly. You sense a presence when you look at them, and they invite you into a world of imagination. Very, very different than some of the work you're doing right now.
In a number of ways it is, but I can't help but put a little bit of my surreal tendencies into some of the landscapes. I found that in some of my surreal work, I was painting figures into the rocks and that sort of thing, kind of an archaeological approach, petroglyphs or whatever, and I found some of them were showing up naturally in the Oregon landscapes as well. People could find them, so I was just doing it without even thinking about it. I guess you could never really escape who you really are.
Do you think that what makes art accessible to people is receptivity? What do you think makes people receptive to a piece of art?
I think people have a natural interest in art. It's a symbol of our civilization. Civilizations are kind of, in a sense, judged by their art. And when we say that a civilization had a decline, very often it's seen in a decline in their arts, which is interesting because in our world today, in a bad economy, art is very often the first thing to go in terms of
absolutely
sales because it's not considered a necessity. Necessity is a relative thing. I think psychologically it's a great necessity. But things have value because people think they have value. You know, we give value to them. And I think people have a natural inclination toward art. They like to beautify their immediate environment where they live. They like to see things that interest them. They like things that absorb the mind, open up new worlds to them, allow them to entertain possibilities. That's what I like to call it. That's true not only of art, but I think of any area of intellectual endeavor, people need to entertain possibilities, because when we're not, we're standing still.
Don't you think that one of the things that's changed a lot since we did a show last in 2004 is that the canvas upon which an artist communicates can now be on more things, on cups, on covers, presentations, computer screens, all kinds of products that we use every day. And so an artist like yourself, who brings gorgeous, beautiful images to life, has a canvas that's a lot bigger and broader than that which simply goes in a gallery.
Well, that's true. There are more ways to show your work now, more ways to create imagery. You know, there are people that are out there creating a lot of computer art. In fact, that's almost totally what they seem to be doing in Hollywood now. Witness the new movies like Avatar and things like that. They're creating some very fascinating imagery for people. So I think the table has expanded in terms of how art is presented and what the artist can do.
Therefore, as an artist who is in commerce, do you think that the marketplace has constricted artists, or do you think that the marketplace is opening up for artists beyond galleries?
Well, we have to be creative in terms of entrepreneurship, and unfortunately for artists, they tend to be poorer entrepreneurs, a lot of them, and I understand that. I tend to be that way, how to market your own work. That's a big problem for a lot of artists. So while there are more opportunities that may be out there, I think sometimes artists have trouble understanding how to access them. I know in my case, sometimes that's been true. Things have changed. And again, back to Hollywood now, you're not using paintings as much as you're using computer work. Now, a number of artists have switched to that. Not all of us are well-trained in computers. I'm still kind of a troglodyte in that regard. I'm still rubbing sticks together to make fire.
You're funny.
I'm not a computer guy.
You don't have to be a computer guy. I mean, this is where I think that artists really need more confidence. Painters don't have to go away, nor do books. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Nor do actual real books that you touch.
Oh, absolutely not. I'm glad you mentioned books, because I really think that books are important. The tactile nature of having something in your hand to read from. It's not a vice to collect books. I've collected a lot of books over the years. I have a very funky anthropological library that I've collected over the years of 100-plus-year-old archaeology books and things like that, where interesting things are talked about that they don't talk about anymore. And it's important to have these things. You're not going to read all that you need to just off of a computer. And I'm afraid, well, it has opened up new horizons. You know, you have information at your fingertips. A lot of people seem to be living their lives on a computer, and that could, in some ways, be, I think, a danger.
I do, too. Do you think that your interest in ancient civilizations and ancient works is impacting the way you live today?
It certainly impacts the way I think about the world, so I guess it impacts the way I live. Am I kind of an ancient at heart? I don't know. Maybe I am. You know, still driving the ox cart.
You know, there's no Social Security or medical insurance after 100 or something. I think they have a totally different policy. It's called the afterlife.
That's right.
There you go.
Yeah, retirement is falling face forward with a brush in your hand.
So what's on the horizon for you? I understand you're working on a new book.
Well, I'm getting ideas together or paintings together that I think can be reproduced and put into a visual format. And there's other work that I've done in the past, collecting information on a potential book regarding the human past, and having hopefully a continuing association with somebody that I haven't talked to for a while, that we're going to do a book together regarding that. I haven't had a chance to follow through with it, but I've collected a lot of information and hope someday to put that together.
Someday is now.
Well,
doing a painting in oil and acrylic, how do you reproduce it into commercial products like cups, screensavers, images that can be used for the computer, posters. How are you looking at reproducing that now? Has anything changed?
Not really. I mean, I still entertain the idea of doing some of that. You know, you have to do it with somebody who's going to take the work, you know, in an association.
You mean like the rainmaking company?
Something like that.
Yeah. I've
rumors about that.
Yeah, it's a rumorful place, you know?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know that John Oberdorf has donated 11 paintings to It's Rainmaking Time, and we will be doing a sale on his paintings. I am in love with his work. We will be posting images of the paintings, the name of them, for sale, and we hope that one of the ways that you support the show and John is to purchase them, and if you know people who would be interested, to let us know. We would really appreciate that. Those are ancient-looking paintings, very much Southwest landscape, Dali-esque, definitely presences some type of otherworldly feeling when you look into the painting.
The work that you have of mine covers kind of a different range from straight landscape, surreal-like, to images where you're looking at a rock wall or something and petroglyphs are staring you in the face. Do you have about 11 of those?
I will recount them, but I think I think I have 11 in total.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. What is it that makes art, art? What makes something art to you?
Well, art is what we say it is. Basically, Picasso said it himself. He said, what is not art? It's a matter of people's opinion about what art is. And that covers a wide range these days, from the red dot on a white canvas to grandma's painting of a little yellow ducky. You know, it's there are so many different varieties of art. And there are a lot of people out there who are in positions of making their livings describing what they think art is. They're called critics. And there are lots of them. And so the way we look at art is basically the way we look at our personal world. Things that people like is what they relate to. There's no one thing that can be said to make up art. I have my own idea of what art is, and I paint it. It's not something you can really put into words. But it comprises a number of things. The way I learned basic principles of how to draw and how to reproduce images on a two-dimensional surface. The basic principles of perspective, as I mentioned before, and composition and color theory and the use of dramatic light, any number of things are tools that we use to comprise an image on a surface. Whatever we put of ourselves into that, we call art.
What's your fascination with Dali?
I think his technical ability was what fascinated me the most about him. I didn't always relate so much to some of the distorted dream imagery, which is what they call a lot of classical surrealism, or the depiction of the artist's psyche on canvas, kind of images from our wild dreams, which end up very distorted sometimes. But I really appreciated the way his technical ability was put into play. He was definitely a master of his materials.
Do you think that conversation is an art?
I think it is, but I also think it's a necessity. It's our basic way of communication. We have to have communicative skills, and speaking is a very basic part of that, communicating with people, talking to them. For an artist, of course, the most important way of communicating is with what they produce visually. But it can be done through conversation, it can be done through art, through music, literature, poetry.
In my world, my little world, conversing, communication is an art and a science.
Mm-hmm.
And through speaking and good communication, you can produce alchemy in someone's life.
Well, that's true. I think you're right.
But because it's the spoken word, unless it's captured, it goes into the air particles. Whereas in your line of work, it manifests itself on canvas. So the way my artistry, for example, manifests is in the spoken word. I'm wondering, what does alchemy have to do with your work?
Well, alchemy basically is changing the state of one thing into another and producing something. There's a Hermetic saying that thoughts have wings.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that what we put into play mentally produces things physically. I think even more now science is finding that the human mind will produce a physical manifestation and cause certain reactions and things to happen on, let's say, a subatomic level maybe, but maybe in other ways as well. Maybe we don't realize the power we have to create something from nothing, so to speak. The alchemists traditionally were known for being able to turn base metals into gold, supposedly. Who knows if any of them were ever able to achieve something like that. But I think that it's true that the human mind produces physical, tangible results.
Absolutely. I notice you have, or you had, a beautiful painting of what looks like Apollo. The guy with the helmet on. It was a black and white.
Oh.
Remember that?
Yes, I think I do. It was black and white. It was actually a drawing in ballpoint pen.
Okay, gorgeous.
I believe. And that was an image that I did of Prometheus.
Prometheus. Talk about Prometheus. What's your interest in Prometheus?
Well, Prometheus is one of the Greek demigods, one of the Titans who warred with the gods and brought fire to mankind, fire being knowledge in our interpretation of it, and was punished by Zeus and chained to a rock. Zeus allowed an eagle to come, and this is not one of the most friendly details, but allowed him to eat at his liver every day. And after he did that, then the liver would grow back, and then he was punished again for it in eternity, supposedly. But the idea of gods or demigods giving knowledge to mankind is something that goes back into the mists of prehistory. The Greek mythology is not the only one that has images of things like that. So that's what Prometheus is about.
And you sold that picture, didn't you?
Quite a long time ago, actually.
That was gorgeous.
That was gorgeous.
I had a lot of fun with ballpoint pen and still do. I haven't done a lot of it lately, but it's one of those instruments. I think it was a basic Bic pen. You can do things with it you can't with any other type of drawing material.
For sure. What is your take on what the imagination is and isn't?
Oh, gosh. We would have to suggest that imagination is everything to us. There's nothing that it isn't, because there may be nothing that we can't imagine. The human mind is capable of many things, but it's absolutely essential for us. If we didn't have it, we would be grazing in a herd somewhere, probably. It's our imagination that produces everything that we are, basically, as a civilization, from art to technology. If you listen to Einstein, he would tell you that he found that his gift of imagination was more important than anything.
The knowledge, even.
In terms of coming up with the theories that he had. He allowed these things to spark into being. I think he thought of the theory of relativity while lying out in a boat in a lake. We would be nothing without it.
When you are painting, do the images come to you in their completion? Or do you find that you're interpreting in spur of the moment? Do you get full pictures of what comes into you as an artist?
Well, sometimes I get full pictures, but when I paint them, they never end up the way I originally conceived them, because they do change as I go along. The painting starts talking to you after a while and telling you what to do. And if you're not paying attention or you're fighting against it, then you're really not painting. You're struggling. So I always pay attention to what the canvas is telling me, and I find things. I'm constantly searching for things, correcting mistakes a lot of the time, things that don't seem to work. I'll paint something in for a couple of days and then decide it doesn't work and I'll have to paint it out. And you have to be kind of ruthless in a way to do that, but if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So it constantly changes for me. And then finally, I decide when enough is enough, when it seems to be done. You can overpaint also.
When you say that the canvas talks to you, that reminds me of poets and writers, that the pieces come into them, it's almost alive. Talk about that.
Well, that's kind of what we would call the muse. Poets always paid attention to the muse, the inspiration. That's another Greek origin there where they get their ideas. There is an artistic muse in a way, and it's basically our own mind. If we're allowing it to work and allowing our imagination to work, the images will come through. And we can be inspired by all sorts of things. Anything can spark it. My interest in prehistory has sparked a number of painting ideas for me. And I tend to pay close attention to that when something is trying to break into my waking world.
Do you find that you ever run into the same thing a lot of writers run into, which is that there are days you absolutely can't paint, or there's moods you get in and you can't paint, or your painting is terrible?
Absolutely.
Talk about that.
No, there's not really much to say about that, except that you do get painter's block, just like writers get writer's block. And there are times when you have to set things aside. I, most of the time, have about four or five paintings going because you can lose objectivity if you're just concentrating on one sometimes. And I've had paintings that started not to work, and I put them aside and forgot about them and picked them out years later and completely corrected them. Or it may happen in a far shorter time span. You know, one night I won't be able to paint. The next day I'll look at it and I'll think, well, what the heck was I doing that for? You know, and wipe that out and do something else and make it work. So, yeah, that's definitely something that happens on occasion. But by and large, I have to be painting at least some of the time. It's just one of those things you find that's part of you. And if you're not doing it over a certain period of time, then there's something not quite right. And the only way you can correct it is to start painting again.
Being that you're in Oregon, have you ever wanted to be somewhere else, living full-time, painting totally different work?
Well, I don't know about painting totally different work, but being in a different place, but sure I have. I get a lot of great imagery from Oregon, and there's a tremendous variety of imagery, from forest to high mountain desert, that sort of thing. So one could be, you know, very happy painting in this area because there's a wealth of material to draw from. But I think of other places as well. So,
what other places interest you?
Oh, gosh. So some of my early imagery, the earliest imagery that I remember comes from Panama, of all places, where my dad was the base commander at the Panama Canal Zone in the 50s.
Wow.
And some of my clearest memories were from about age 2.5. Where I remember the white sand beaches of Panama and the large volcanic rocks. I remember one time sitting on the beach with my dad, and there was this white sand everywhere, and behind us was the lush vegetation. And he told me to get on top of this rock quickly that was about the size of a bed. And I did, and from behind us came a rustling, and then hundreds of thousands of little orange-red crabs came crawling out of the brush and covering the white sand, orange-red, and they parted around the rock we were on.
I would have screamed.
And, you know, you can't pay for something like that. It's just, I think my surrealistic tendencies were sparked in those times by images like that. It shows you that the world is a varied place with a lot of different things going on. We have to pay attention to it when we can. And that's one of those things that I remember very vividly. And I would also remember watching him take off in his C-47 from the runway, and I'd be standing there waving at him. And to a child, a runway stretches out forever. And so you get the fundamentals of perspective right there without even really knowing it. Time, distance, all of those things come into play. And so later on, we draw on these images, and it has an effect on us. It certainly affected ultimately the way I paint and the way I think.
When you look at your paintings, one feels like they're in the thing they're looking at. Not like they're looking at it, but like all of a sudden they're in it. How is that able to happen? How do you do that?
Well, it's because that's the way I look at it. I look at them kind of as windows. And I'm not out there to give people lessons or something like that. I'm asking questions. And as I paint, I'm asking these questions. And when I'm done, I guess my hope would be that people would look at them in the same way that I did and have it affect them in a similar way to myself, although they'll draw their own conclusions from it and have their own way of looking at it, but it will draw them in and cause them to ask questions as well.
What fascinates you about life, John?
Well, on the very face of it, the fact that I'm here, I find miraculous.
Like gratitude?
Well, yeah, in a sense. I mean, we have all sorts of stuff thrown at us all the time in our lives, and I guess part of the challenge is in dealing with them, and I suspect that we're here to learn because I detect that there is a reason for being here. Otherwise, we wouldn't spend so much time thinking about it. Nature doesn't allow for a lot of frivolity, and it singles species out for extinction that don't get the message. So there must be a reason for us asking these questions. Otherwise, we'd be wasting our time. I'm grateful for being here. I think that I'm learning as I go. Life is the college of hard knocks, ultimately. But we can be grateful for those moments of inspiration and awareness, moments, I would say, of uncommon perception when we learn something new. That's another stage of the initiatory level in life.
You have anything you want that can happen in the next year, anything. Where are you? What are you doing?
I don't know about the where of it, but the what of it is basically doing the work that I do and being in a situation where I can freely do it. That's what I work for, and that's where, of course, I'd like to be.
How would you like to be remembered, John?
I guess as somebody who did what he thought was best with the abilities that he'd been given and hopefully made some sort of contribution to the way people look at the world. Maybe that's a tall order.
I think that's great. I think that's wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with, listening to, and learning from John Oberdorf, surreal landscape artist who works on many different types of canvases and many different types of environments. He has this ability to bring us into new worlds and does what I call a form of initiatory art. John, is there anything else you'd like to say before we complete this segment?
Well, I'm just grateful for being able to talk to you, and thank you for being there to ask me the questions and having the interest.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are interested in the work of John Oberdorf, we're going to put some images on the page here. Feel free to call the Rainmaking Company at 626-398-8652. This will help support the show and John, and we thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.
It's Rainmaking Time.